This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to LGIM Talks. It's not often we home in on a particular country here on the pod, but the nomination of a new governor, a wage settlement far in excess of the current 4% rate of inflation, a currency that until recently hit a 40-year low against the US dollar, and a fiscal deficit that is now over twice that as a percentage of GDP, has made for some rather interesting headlines. The country in question is Japan, and here to talk to me, Frances Watson, about why we believe Japanese equities remain an interesting asset class is Chris Teschmacher, one of the fund managers on the asset allocation team. Chris, morning to you and welcome to LGIM Talks.
Thank you, Frances. It's good to be here on the podcast and to talk about Japan. There's a few major themes in financial markets at the moment that seem to impact pretty much all economies, meaning that they're all kind of dancing to the same beat. But in that sense, it is a bit unusual to talk about one country in particular, but there's two countries that we think are dancing to their own tune. One of them is China, and the other one is Japan. So as an asset allocator, we're always looking for different stories, differentiated asset classes that help us build diversified portfolios. So in that sense, I'm keen to talk about Japan, hear your questions and share our views.
Great. OK, well, look, shall we just peel back for a little bit and start with Japan's fiscal imbalance? I mean, why does it have the greatest amount of debt in relation to GDP of any Western economy, do you think, Chris?
Yeah, so you can trace Japan's debt problems all the way back to kind of its economic boom and the aftermath and the so-called lost decade. So in the early 90s, there wasn't much spectacular about Japan's debt, but decades of weak economic growth and deflation have led policymakers into kind of a continued cycle of attempting to resuscitate and stimulate the economy with debt. And so there have been brief spells where that's kind of worked, it's been successful. But for one reason or another, either domestically created problems or some external or global issues, the cycle has repeated itself many times over for the last three decades. So the result's been a kind of steady upward rise of Japanese government debt, which, like you said, is now the highest in the world for major economies. By kind of the late 1990s, Japan had already started, Bank of Japan already started what we would now call quantitative easing or QE. And for a decade, it was kind of an outlier in that sense. No one else was doing it. It was unusual until the US, UK and Europe joined the pack. And then post 2008, it's kind of become normal for many economies or central banks to do that. But Bank of Japan was far earlier in starting that policy and that process. Now, the most recent turn of the wheel has seen the Bank of Japan engaging in something called yield curve control since 2016. And the aim of that policy is to keep short end rates low, which should encourage corporate borrowing and investment. But it's also trying to suppress longer end rates, given the unwanted side effects of extremely low long end rates on pension funds and life insurers. So yeah, this combination of policies over many decades has led to Japan's huge amount of debt relative to GDP.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because you mentioned yield curve control there. And there has been intervention recently, as I understand it, from the Bank of Japan to try and keep those rates down. But are we at a point now, do you think, Chris, where the corollary of all this fiscal debt that has been built up over the decades means higher interest rates are now inevitable? Is it time for Japan to dance in tune with the other Western economies?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, in the case of Japan, it's not necessarily true. So investors have frequently taken a negative view on Japanese government bonds back to the 90s and repeatedly so. But the trade has kind of failed so many times that it's become known as a widow maker in investment circles. So it's the same again today. Investors are again putting pressure on Japanese government bonds, expecting yields to rise. But the Bank of Japan's resolve on yield curve control is therefore kind of being tested. Now, over time, the band for 10-year yields on yield curve control has been widened. In 2018, it went to plus or minus 0.1%, 2021 up to 0.25%. And then in December last year, that moved again. So the band for yield curve control is now plus or minus 0.5%. As long as inflation remains low, the Bank of Japan is saying that yield curve control will remain in place. And specifically, they want wage inflation to come up so that overall inflation sustainably meets that 2% target that they have. Now, inflation as a whole is rising, and so that investor pressure is there. They're speculating that the policy, the yield curve control policy, will be abandoned or significantly loosened. That was so intense in January that the yields on government bonds actually did go over that 0.5% cap that I mentioned earlier, which was a significant bit of news in Japan and for government bond investors. But the Bank of Japan since then has remained pretty stubborn. In fact, it now owns remarkably over 100% of all 10-year government bonds. And in January, we saw the fastest pace of purchases from the Bank of Japan on record, over 20 trillion yen in a single month. So yeah, you said in the intro as well, we've got the new Bank of Japan governor being nominated, but Ueda as well, who should be coming in, has also poured kind of cold water on the chances of anything changing. He said that a continuation of monetary policy easing is appropriate. And he kind of warned about the high levels of financial market uncertainty and in the global economy as well.
So just summing it up for us, in terms of the JGBs, a huge market, in terms of the fact that the BOJ has got control of this market at the moment, what does that mean for foreign investors then, Chris? Does that mean they're steering clear of Japanese bonds altogether?
Yes, I think the consensus trade and what everyone likes to talk about is having a negative view on Japanese government bonds, or in some circles, that means even taking short positions. That's especially the case for foreign investors, and we see that in the positioning as well. But we actually think from here, statements like expecting yield curve control to end this year are actually a little bit pointless. It's already well priced into the markets, so it's very hard to actually be profitable on that view from this point. It's quite expensive even to be short or negative Japanese government bonds. And so we don't think that's a position that's going to be fruitful in the short term. Markets, of course, do move. So there are going to be periods along the way where the narrative changes and that trade may become more interesting again. But right now, we wouldn't say that's the case. You look at the underlying inflation data as well, which is ultimately what people think is going to drive the Bank of Japan to abandon yield curve control. And that hasn't really changed too much. There's no indication that there's structural change to inflation in Japan. Underlying inflation pressures remain kind of subdued. And the longer term forecasts for inflation are also pretty kind of low as well. For 2024, 25, they're close to 1% compared to the last decade of 0.8%. So there's not really been a structural shift yet.
Okay, that's interesting. So just turning then from Japanese bonds to equities, and earlier on this year, you produced your CIO outlook for 2023. And as part of the asset allocation team, you wrote, regionally, Japan is our preferred market, given the desynchronized nature of its recovery. You've sort of alluded to that already, but just tell us in a little bit more detail what you mean by that.
Yes, the equity investment case actually rests on a few different things. So it's fiscal stimulus and it's post-COVID reopening, and that re-emergence of some inflation, at least in the short term, may help to drive consumer spending. So those three things in combination might drive consumer spending, which we think is going to be positive for Japanese equities. Now, the full extent of fiscal stimulus is a little bit hard to quantify. There's been quite a few historic examples of fiscal stimulus, record-breaking budgets, etc. And it's not always provided kind of any meaningful results in the past or proved to be too important. But the difference this time is that the stimulus appears to be large and is occurring when the economy is reopening post-COVID and is already close to kind of full employment. So this is about magnitude and timing. We think consensus might be underestimating the impact of that stimulus. We think that it could lead to a meaningful acceleration in consumer spending, which will boost Japanese corporate profits at a time when, you know, a lot of people are talking about recession and slowdown in profits in other regions.
Can you put a number on EPS growth for us then?
I think it's not actually important to be too particular on where EPS growth is going to be as a particular number. It's more about the relative direction here. So corporate profit slowdown in other regions, in the US in particular, is quite well forecast, whereas we think they're going to be more robust in Japan. Similarly, you kind of look at PMI data as well. In Japan, those numbers are kind of flat, where other countries are starting to see declines in their PMI. So it's about relative strength that we think will help the Japanese equity market rather than absolute strength, shall we say.
Okay, great. Now, you've talked a bit about inflation and underlying inflation. What we haven't touched on is the spring wage round, which I think is the Shunto wage round in Japan. I hope I've got all my pronunciations right on this call. And what caught my eye a couple of weeks ago was, I think it was a casual clothing retailer, is it Uniqlo, awarded their workers a 40% pay increase, which is substantially above the rate of headline inflation, which I think is only 4%. First of all, how does that feed into the inflation equation generally? And secondly, I guess that's going to stir animal spirits. It's going to help the consumer. But how on earth is that going to impact company margins?
I think you're right. It's called Shunto Wage Round. I was doing some research before the podcast as to what that actually meant. It translates to the spring wage offensive, which I thought was an interesting translation. I think, you know, at the surface level, higher inflation is kind of welcome. Policymakers have been trying to achieve higher inflation for decades, and the deflationary mindset can be really hard to get out of and causes kind of a series of economic problems and issues. And it's very kind of spiraling phenomenon that reinforces that deflationary mindset. So at the surface, I think they'd be glad to be out of that with inflation at a kind of 4-decade high at the moment. When it does come to wages, the Shunto wage round is actually in itself losing some importance. So membership of unions has kind of dropped over time. And because of that deflationary mindset, it's been so long that the main objective of the wage rounds has actually been to secure the number of jobs, maintaining jobs and some pay stability, rather than really achieving significant pay rises. But this year, it's different. So they're now calling for 5% rise in wages. That would be the highest since 1995. But we've seen a number of companies moving kind of ahead of the main wage rounds. Like you said, fast retailing was the first to make a very early and really significant announcement of a 40% pay rise, or as high as 40% pay rise for staff. And there's a number of other companies making kind of similar headline grabbing announcements as well. It has been done kind of against the backdrop of already tight labor market. So it is about retaining staff here. And then the other elements of inflation are less welcome. So when it comes to energy and commodity prices, that's kind of been driving a lot of the inflation. And that's kind of the wrong type of inflation that policymakers don't really want to see. So in that regard, Prime Minister Kishida is aiming to actually reopen a number of nuclear power plants, which have been idle since the 2011 Fukushima crisis. The aim there is to, reduce the impact of higher energy costs. That's been met in the past by a lot of resistance, understandable public resistance. But a recent survey, given the kind of pressure on energy prices, has actually showed 51% support for restarting reactors versus 42% against. And that's the first time that survey showed more supporters than opponents since the disaster.
Yeah, I was going to say, because at this time last year, of course, oil prices were sky high, weren't they? I think $140 a barrel. And of course, Japan is a major importer, isn't it? It doesn't have any of its own oils. So just sticking with companies, what types of companies dominate the topics index then, Chris? Is it exporters? Is it mainly domestic companies?
Yeah, so there's obviously a mix, as with any kind of region. As an asset allocator, we're kind of mainly interested in the sectoral maker of those companies. We, talking about exports and imports, It's a country that does import a lot of commodities and then exports finished goods. And overseas inflation rising, commodity prices didn't help. So last year, imports rose by 42% in value, whilst exports only grew by 20% in value. That certainly hasn't been helpful. And if we dig into the kind of sectors in particular, we see an overweight to cyclicals in general, but also consumer discretionary stocks. In our view, that kind of large representation of consumer discretionary stocks is a helpful thing because we're trying to focus here on a consumer spending story that's at the heart of our equity kind of view. You do get some underweights as well. So you have slightly less in technology and commodity stocks. Like I said, it's a commodity importer, so not a lot there. And then you kind of question, how do equities broadly perform in different macro environments as well? Well, yeah, being overweight cyclicals isn't necessarily a great thing because I've got an overall view on an impending recession globally. But still, when we're targeting a consumer story in Japan, we think that's relatively outweighed. And so, yeah, really hits to the point of the investment case.
Sure, that's interesting. That's a good overview of sector allocation there. Thanks for that. Look, we can't talk about Japan without we talk about the currency. I mean, last year was notable, wasn't it, for the yen weakness, which, as I said in the intro, touched a 40-year low against the US dollar, and was weak against practically every major currency, of course, impacting returns for overseas investors. What's likely to happen this year, in your view, Chris?
It's been an embattled currency. As the rest of the world raises rates, the Bank of Japan has kind of remained firm on its yield curve control. And so the interest differential between the US, UK, Europe, et cetera, has been growing and is now pretty significant. And that's been driving currency depreciation for the yen. That story continues to be kind of highly correlated to yield curve control. So as I mentioned earlier, speculation about that breaking or being abandoned has led to a little bit of strength in the yen this year, and it's recovered a little bit of the underperformance. That's going to continue if that story kind of continues. But there's also another way of looking at that, which we think is interesting, and which means you actually need to look abroad. It is about what's happening in the US and Europe and the UK, etc. So earlier this year, yields in those markets were coming down. That weakened the US dollar after its kind of relentless march higher in 2022. And that helped the yen as well a little bit earlier this year. Now, what we've seen in the last month is this kind of no landing scenario being priced into other economies where economic growth remains reasonable, labor markets robust, etc. And that means more inflation and higher rates in the US. That's been driving the dollar to get stronger again and the yen to get weaker again. So actually we see potentially a negative view on the yen as a possible hedge for higher US inflation. It's less about the domestics and more about the foreign aspects as well.
So driven by dollar and the path of the dollar yet again, it looks like that's what you're telling me.
Yeah, exactly. Well, as long as the Bank of Japan remains kind of stubborn and guided by yield curve control, it's actually overseas impacts that are going to drive the yen rather than domestics, in our view.
So we've talked a bit about the economy and inflation. Let's just end on a personal note, really. Have you ever been to Japan, Chris? I must say I never have. Have you?
I have, actually. It was quite a number of years ago, and it was only on a business trip, but it did inspire me, hopefully, to make a return one day. It's not the easiest with kids, maybe, to go, or young kids, anyway. But
long flight, yeah.
It is something I hope to do in the future. I went to Japan, had a few days there, and was lucky enough to have colleagues that kind of were willing to show me around when we didn't have business meetings on. It's a very interesting country, very different to any other place you'll visit. So it was all the kind of the little things that interested me the most, actually. The different pieces of technology, the cultures of the taxi driver opening your door with a little mechanical mechanism rather than having to do it yourself. These little cultural differences, which I found fascinating.
And lots of vending machines, so I'm told.
Lots of vending machines and automated bits and pieces and fascinating kind of strange ways of going about life if you're not used to them. So
Exactly. I think we could learn a bit more from their technology, given my weakness in my Wi-Fi during this podcast. But look, Chris, fascinating to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining LGIM Talks. I found it really interesting. And thank you to you, and thank you to all our listeners.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties, and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. Copyright 2022. Legal and General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, the licensed corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.